knowledge and perceptions of a COVID infection.
How many steps do you need to take to stay healthy?
Outcomes of critically ill patients with COVID infection.
And look at the diet of children in the U.S.
That's what we'll be talking today on Double T Health Watch, brought to you by Rick Lang, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster, and my partner, Elizabeth Tracy, a Baltimore-based medical reporter. Elizabeth, first time I've actually made the introduction.
It's amazing. After all these years, what's that, 15 years? Well, of course, we're going to start with the COVID update. So which of those two would you like to start with?
Let's start with the one that I thought was pretty interesting. That is talking about the knowledge and perceptions of COVID infection. And this was done among the general public, both in the United States and in the United Kingdom. And why that's important, because obviously human behavior is influenced by our knowledge and perception, and particularly in this case of the COVID infection or COVID disease. This was a study done. They have a representative of about 80,000 people, but they culled down about 3,000 individuals in the United States and 3,000 in the United Kingdom. They had the characteristics that they said they thought represented the general census. And they asked them 22 different questions about COVID infection. And I'm not going to go over all these, but I'm just going to summarize. What they found is that the general knowledge about COVID was pretty good, but there were several different misperceptions or misinformation. For example, they asked how many people in the U.S. or U.K. do you think will die from the coronavirus infection by the end of 2020? This survey was done the last week of February. About two-thirds answered that less than 500 people would die in the U.S. or U.K. They asked them, how could you prevent COVID infection? 90% used the usual things. If you wash your hands, avoid close contact, avoid touching your hands and nose. But about a third of individuals said other things like using a hand dryer or regularly rinsing your nose with saline or taking antibiotics or gargling mouthwash. And we know that, by the way, none of those things help to prevent COVID infection. Surprisingly, when they said, what percentage of you think that consistently wearing a face mask is highly effective in protecting you, it was only about a third of individuals. A lot of misperceptions, and those misperceptions guide really how we approach it.
One of the things that I'm finding somewhat disconcerting is that there is a high prevalence of misinformation that's out there, especially on social media. I just read this morning about Facebook and its attempts to try to keep people informed and correctly informed. I'm sure that's a Herculean task to try to stay on top of what people are saying on there. And I also think it's extremely dangerous from a public health standpoint for people to be promulgating this kind of misinformation.
Absolutely. And not only this, but with regard to treatment, I mean, there are a lot of people looking to try to find effective treatments. And the answer is we don't have any right now, but there is a lot of misinformation. And in fact, recently, there was an Arizona couple that died. This issue of using hydroxychloroquine and antibiotics, azithromycin, to help prevent it. Well, they read this and actually took a substance that is used for their pet fish tank, and it was chloroquine phosphate, not hydroxychloroquine. And the husband died, and the woman's in critically ill condition. Misinformation, Double T Health Watch helps to avoid some of that misinformation and put good information into the hands of our listeners.
Why don't we go to, since we're speaking of health, and there are other things going on besides COVID-19, even though it doesn't seem that's the case, to the Journal of the American Medical Association, a look at step counts and what their impact is on mortality. Lots and lots of information about this. I can link it, of course, in my journalistic way to COVID-19 by saying, yes, people are told they can go outside and walk. And so I guess if you can get a pedometer, if you don't already have one delivered to you, you could actually improve your health this way. They took a look at a set of adults who were at least 40 years of age as part of NHANES, the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey. And all these folks wore an accelerometer for up to 7 days between 2003 and 2006, and then they assessed mortality data through December 2015. They took a look at the number of steps per day and three intensity measures during the 7 day period or so that the person wore the accelerometer. They looked at the primary outcome of all-cause mortality, secondary outcomes, cardiovascular disease, and cancer mortality. And they also corrected for age, sex, race, ethnicity, education, diet, smoking, BMI, self-reported health, mobility limitations, and the diagnoses of diabetes, stroke, heart disease, heart failure, cancer, chronic bronchitis, and emphysema. They had a total of almost 5,000 participants, mean age 57 years, approximately equally divided between men and women. The mean number of steps per day was just under 10,000. And we have heard that a million times, that we all need to be taking 10,000 steps per day. Sure enough, they saw that those folks who took less than 4,000 steps per day had the highest mortality. Those who took 4,000 to just under 8,000 steps per day, significant decrease. And then interestingly, not such a great increase for those as they went higher. They also found that your greater step intensity, if you went faster, if you went up and down more stairs, presumably, was not associated with lower mortality after they adjusted for the total steps per day. So folks, get out there and walk.
So let's put some numbers on it. You talked about a lower mortality of 8,000 steps versus 4,000 steps. That was a 50% reduction in mortality. And that was all-cause mortality. By the way, they looked at cardiovascular mortality. That was decreased. They looked at cancer mortality. That was decreased. The mortality benefits extended for men and for women, for whites, blacks, and Hispanics. Shortcomings to this data. It is observational. If you walk more and try to get somewhere between 8,000 to 10,000 steps per day, it does improve overall cardiovascular and likely cancer mortality as well.
Right, and since we're advising people to get outside for lots of reasons, of course, practice your social isolation. Don't get within 6 feet of another person. This is a pretty apt study for the moment.
It's more important how far you walk and less important the intensity.
Let us turn back then to COVID-19. Also in the Journal of the American Medical Association.
This is a research letter that talks about the characteristics and outcomes of the 21 critically ill patients with COVID-19 in Washington State. It reports on ICU patients that were admitted at a hospital in Seattle between February 20th and March 5th. 21 cases in the ICU, mean age was about 70 years, although some as young as 43 and some as old as 92. Most of those, you won't be surprised, had comorbidities, because we talked about the fact those are the individuals most likely to have intensive care needs. Comorbidities like kidney disease and heart failure. Most of these patients had shortness of breath, about 50% had fever or cough. Onset of symptoms prior to presenting to the hospital was only about 3.5 days. About a day and a half after being in the hospitals when they were admitted to the intensive care unit. Most of these individuals had an abnormal chest x-ray, a low white cell count, and many had abnormalities in the liver enzymes. About 3/4 of these patients ended up being on mechanical ventilation. Other data have suggested it's somewhere between 50 and 70%. Something that was previously unknown is about 1/3 of these patients present with a cardiomyopathy. That's an infection of the heart. Mortality, about 67%. And 24% of the patients remained critically ill, and only about 10% were discharged from the ICU.
I think it's been really interesting to take a look at the data that's emerging across the United States and note the differences in mortality rates across the U.S., with Washington remaining as one of those foci that has the highest mortality relative to number of cases.
I'll remind our listeners is that the epicenter of this was actually in a skilled nursing center. Those individuals, by definition, are older individuals and oftentimes have high number of comorbidities as well. And I think that accounts for why the mortality in this particular group was higher than it is in many places across the U.S.
Well, I think one thing that this study also points out is the prolonged period of time that people are in the ICU.
Absolutely. The average length of stay for these individuals is between 12 to 15 days in the hospital. Most of the time we hospitalize individuals, they're not in for 12 to 15 days. They're consuming resources that aren't available for other patients and ventilators. This is going to be a significant issue. We're facing an ethical issue about how do we ration ventilators in these individuals when we don't have enough to treat every patient.
And so we would draw our listeners' attention to the New England Journal of Medicine, where a task force has published criteria for helping to objectively establish how ventilators will be used.
And they do this through what's called a ventilator triage committee. It doesn't involve the primary care physician. It's an outside group, independently, that makes recommendations based upon the fact that we just have limited resources.
And hopefully won't become necessary in many places around the world. Let us turn then to our final study for this week, which is also in the Journal of the American Medical Association. And this is a look at diet trends among youth in the United States between 1999 and 2016. Again, from NHANES, a serial cross-section investigation using 24-hour dietary recalls from youth aged 2 to 19 years. I don't know any 2-year-old who's able to tell me with any veracity what they ate in the last 24 hours. But of course, this was surrogates who were providing this information when they were interviewed. They were specifically assessing how good is your diet relative to the American Heart Association perfect diet, if you will. There's also secondary outcomes that are relative to that AHA diet, including things like the consumption of nuts, seeds, legumes, processed meat, and saturated fat, with the primary one looking at total fruits and vegetables, whole grains, fish and shellfish, and sugar-sweetened beverages, and sodium. Just over 31,000 youth in that age group, 2 to 19, are included in this. The upshot of the whole thing is that the estimated proportion of youth who have a poor diet in 2015 to 2016 was just about 40%. In those aged 2 to 5, 52.5%, and 6 to 11, and almost 2/3 in the 12 to 19 cohort. So I guess when they get to the place where they're able to make their own dietary choices, they actually are worse. Not surprisingly, there's a persistent difference across levels of parental education, household income, and household food security status.
As you said, they took all the recommendations and they said, how often do the youth adhere to the diet? If their adherence rate was less than 40%, they call that a poor diet. Between 40 and 80%, they call that intermediate. And above 80%, they call that an ideal or great dietary compliance. What I think is important to note is that decreased substantially. At the initiation of the study in 1999, 77% had a poor diet, but by the end of the study, it was down to 56%. We'd say 56% is not good, and I agree with you, it's not terrific, but what those individuals did is more of a move from the poor adherence to the intermediate. In the ideal range, it was less than 1% across the entire time. It didn't get substantially better during that time period. The diet in the very young individuals, that's determined by the parents. And the fact that there was such a high, poor dietary adherence in that young group means we as parents need to get serious about teaching our kids, because those habits translate later into their dietary adherence as well.
Yep, I absolutely agree with you. So parents, get out there and make good choices for your kids, because you're influencing the rest of their life.
There were a couple of things that I thought that were really nice. As you look at sugar beverages, they went down. Sugar intake, they went down. Better intake of fruits and vegetables. We got to move from the intermediate range to the ideal range.
Let's end on that up note that things are moving in the right direction. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up and make healthy choices.